Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last August, President Obama unveiled a plan that changes how we generate and use energy in the future. He calls it the Clean Power Plan. It sets new standards for states to reduce carbon dioxide emissions, and big coal-producing states such as Ohio will be affected more than others. 27 states, including Ohio and some energy companies, have sued the U.S. EPA over the plan. The U.S. Court of Appeals in January rejected a proposal to freeze it, but opponents are set to appear in the District of Columbia Court of Appeals in June. The case is expected to go before the Supreme Court sometime in 2017. Today we're talking about how the Clean Power Plan might affect Ohio. We'll hear from proponents and opponents this hour. Joining us is Ohio State University energy and environmental economist Noah Dormady. Welcome to the show, Noah.
Thank you.
Also joining us by phone is a reporter for Midwest Energy News, Kathy Ann Kowalski. Welcome to the show, Kathy Ann.
Thank you.
All right, so the Clean Power Plan was proposed in August with the goal of reducing carbon dioxide emissions by 32% by 2030. What are the experts saying about its plausibility, Kathy Ann Kowalski?
Well, it depends on who you talk with. If you were to check with the people challenging the plan, their position is there's no way in the world we can do this without crippling the economy. When you talk with EPA and also with a variety of environmental groups, they say, well, this is eminently doable when we crunch the numbers and start working through them under the different options that are given to us. So it really depends in part on your perspective. When EPA shows its calculations, they're looking at overall, I believe, about a 37% reduction from Ohio, but there are also analyses that say the state can get most of the way there if it uses some emissions trading, some energy efficiency, and some renewable energy in the mix.
Dr. Dormady, what do you, as far as plausibility goes, when we talk about it, there's two sides to that coin. There's the one that, can we do it? Well, of course, if we just quit driving cars and, you know, it's all plausible. But we're also talking within the realm of economic reality. And what are your thoughts about that?
Well, so it's a little too early to tell right now what the economic impacts will be because the plan was just released, within the past few months. And so there haven't been a whole lot of macroeconomic impact studies. EPA has done its study, and EPA estimates that the net benefit, it won't be a net cost, of the plan will be anywhere between $26 and $45 billion in total.
Okay.
And so that's a sizable benefit to the macroeconomy. Now, the EPA is taking into account co-benefits, and those are health benefits associated with things like co-pollutants, health benefits associated with things like reduced, missed days from work, when people are more healthier, they're more productive. And so the EPA is taking account of those co-benefits and those environmental and co-health benefits. The problem with that is, in many ways, that those are very difficult to monetize. And so the EPA's estimates will likely be revised in the coming months by additional NGOs and academic groups that do their own macroeconomic impact studies.
But will they all take into account those co-benefits?
Most of them do not.
Okay. So it won't be an apples-to-apples comparison on...
Absolutely.
It won't
correct.
Be that the numbers are different. It'll be that the factors are different.
That's absolutely correct.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the potential impact, good and bad, of the president's Clean Power Plan. It was proposed back in August. A lot, as Dr. Noah Dormady just explained, a lot of people are still juggling these numbers, trying to make sense of them. The EPA has its own analysis. Joining us by phone is Kathy Ann Kowalski. She's a reporter for Midwest Energy News, and Noah Dormady, environmental economist at Ohio State, is with us in the studio. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Kathy Ann Kowalski, climate change has been a public policy issue for many years. Why the push for a plan like this now? What is this? Is this a tipping point of some sort?
Well, I guess when you say why the push for climate change regulation now, One of the things is this is not new. Back in 2007, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that that U.S. EPA had to regulate greenhouse gases in order to address climate change. When you look at when you talk about a tipping point, one of the things that's happened is, you know, if you go back 27, 28, 29 years, nobody was talking about climate change. But science has come forward in the last couple of decades. And since the late first decade of the century, I think 2007, 2008 was probably around when the International Panel on Climate Change came out and said, yes, you know, we do believe there is good evidence, firm evidence, that humans are influencing climate change. And the push now with trying to curb the gases really is to try to mitigate and avoid some of the worst impacts of climate change that could happen. When you look at the historic record, the last time that this rate of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases was going up into the atmosphere at anything even approaching this scale. Granted, it was still larger then, but we're getting into within an order of magnitude of what happened during one of the last great extinctions on Earth.
And by the way, the Ohio General Assembly in 2008, almost unanimously, I think there was just one person who voted against it, passed a bill that called for a fourth of power sold in Ohio to be generated by alternative technology by 2025. They were well on their way to that. But last spring, Ohio lawmakers voted and the governor signed into law another measure that froze those clean energy and efficiency standards. If lawmakers don't come up with a compromise, the governor said, though, that the tougher standards would resume in 2017. Do we know much about the impact of those standards on the economy at this point, Noah Dormady?
So a couple of points on that. First of all, it's not a matter of if the state of Ohio actually uses renewables. They have to under the Clean Power Plan. The Clean Power Plan has three very important, you know, legs of its stool, if you will. The first of which is, you know, reducing emissions from coal. The second of which is reducing emissions from natural gas. And the third is more renewable energy. And any state plan that the EPA approves, I can't see going forward without additional renewable energy. Within the state of Ohio, though, I was asked by a reporter up in Cleveland a few months ago and was, quoted in the paper up in Cleveland as saying that there's no studies out that look at the economic impacts of more renewable energy here in Ohio. And the truth of the matter is there's lots of evidence from other states. And I was very critical, in my comments to the reporter. I said, you know, we don't really need another study. Why do we need another study when we've got a number of other states that have shown net benefits of additional renewables? And so I think when you look at states like Pennsylvania, and there have been a number of studies, I've done my own for Pennsylvania, and we find net benefits for additional renewables.
As far as a study goes, I mean, isn't there any analysis out there, though, of how the existing reduction or increase in renewables was, what kind of impact it was having in Ohio for 8 years? Or for 7 years? Kathy Ann Kowalski?
Yeah, there's information. Noah, you can jump in here, but I've seen information from groups like Ohio Advanced Energy Economy showing the growth in jobs, for example, in the renewable energy sector. Noah, you know more about it than I do, but.
Yeah, so I'm not entirely familiar with all the studies here in Ohio, but I can tell you for as far as other states are concerned, we don't really need an additional study is really the point. We already know that there's net benefits from additional renewables.
So by the Ohio General Assembly then passing the latest legislation that puts a freeze on those increases in renewables and decreases in carbon dioxide emitters, has there been a net benefit? Do we know if there's been has that had a bad effect on the Ohio economy?
The Ohio economy has continued to grow,
right?
And it's grown at an even faster pace than the rest of the nation in a number of measures. And so any evidence that would support that the renewable standards have been detrimental to the economy is unfounded at best.
Okay.
And if I can add to that, mm-hmm. Look at California. I mean, California is moving to a 50% renewable standard. And California's economy continues to be a powerhouse economy. And so, you know, you look at you look at states that have very stringent, very aggressive renewable standards, and it's added greatly to their macro economies.
Each state is supposed to have their own plan to achieve the goal. When do they need that ready? When is that plan supposed to be in the work?
They need to have it by this June.
By this June. What do we know about Ohio's plan, Kathy Ann Kowalski?
One of the things that's going on is even though Ohio is among the states that is opposing the Clean Power Plan and the litigation, Ohio EPA is on a track to try to move forward to put an initial submission in by June that would then give them more time to finish working out all the details. According to Craig Butler at Ohio EPA, this is one of their top priorities because, as he sees it, he told me that he sees that there's a massive job there trying to figure everything out and get the best mix. And it's really, I believe, in my view, at least, in Ohio's interest to do that, because if they don't come up with a plan by the end of June that at least meets the initial requirements, then they are at risk of having to take whatever the federal default plan would be. And under the Supremacy Clause, the federal EPA would be able to impose that on the state. So it's a little bit like imagining, if you're a kid at school and you're told you have to have a green vegetable with your lunch, and you start arguing, about, oh, I don't want to pick anything, you run the risk that at the end of the day, if you lose, you could be stuck with kale instead of something like asparagus.
Okay. Now, correct me if I'm oversimplifying this, but when the president's plan came out in August, proponents of it immediately said that if the Ohio General Assembly just went back and deleted that law that they passed last spring, freezing the standards that were underway, if it just returned to that trajectory that it was on, they'd be fine. They'd be meeting all of the goals of the first stage of this.
Yeah, at least for the first stage of having to achieve specific levels. In other words, under US EPA's plan, they put in their initial submission, and then there are target dates for different levels they have to meet. And yeah, at least for the initial levels, they would be fine.
I find it very hard to believe, though, that the EPA would approve that alone as a plan for the state of
Ohio. No, I agree with you, Noah.
That would get them to the first stage, but you're saying that there's more to it than that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, under the Clean Air Act, which is really the regulatory framework under which the Clean Power Plan is founded, the EPA mandates what we call BSERs, or Best Systems of Emissions Reductions, and those call for very stringent cleanup levels, if you will, emissions reductions or efficiencies at our coal plants and our natural gas plants. And the renewable standard alone just would not meet those BSERs.
Well, and I agree with that, because one of the things that would happen is you'd meet the initial levels, but you'd have to show that your plan is going to meet all the levels eventually.
Absolutely.
And then the other thing is that just traditionally, since modern federal environmental regulations started coming in the 80s, they are technology forcing, and they do require what are considered the best standards for performance in various industries.
We're going to continue our conversation about the impact of the president's Clean Power Plan. It was unveiled in August with the goal of reducing carbon dioxide emissions by roughly a third by 2030. We're talking about what the experts are saying about its plausibility. Coming up, we'll hear from the Natural Resources Defense Council. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. 10 years ago, Ohio had the fifth highest carbon dioxide emissions in the nation. Since then, the state has reduced those emissions and now ranks 23rd in the country. The Ohio General Assembly in 2008 almost unanimously voted for a bill that called for a fourth of power sold in Ohio to be generated by alternative technology by 2025. Last spring, Ohio lawmakers voted and the governor signed into law another measure that froze existing clean energy and efficiency standards. If lawmakers don't come up with a compromise, the tougher standards would resume in 2017. Now, President Obama's Clean Power Plan requires each state to reduce emissions by almost a third from 2005 levels. Lots of numbers, lots of dates in there. We're talking about the impact of that policy on Ohio. Still with us in the studio is OSU energy and environmental economist Noah Dormady. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
And by phone, reporter at Midwest Energy News, Kathy Ann Kowalski. Kathy Ann, thanks again.
Sure.
And joining us now by phone as well from the Natural Resources Defense Council, David Doniger. Welcome to the show, David.
Thanks very much. Nice to be there.
Opponents say these standards are set too high for coal-dependent states like Ohio to reach, that it's just not fair. David Doniger, how do you respond to that?
Well, I think it is very fair that the standards require the same level of effort from coal plants everywhere in the country. And there's another standard that requires the same level of effort from gas-fired plants everywhere in the country. And the standard for Ohio as a state just reflects the mix of coal and gas plants that the state starts with. So actually, Ohio has a more lenient standard than, let's say, one of the eastern states or California, because it starts from more emissions and more coal. And in this sense, the whole thing is quite balanced and fair.
You know, Kathy Ann Kowalski, I was reading that the federal government is coming forth with some grant money to help states like Ohio adjust to these changes when it comes to jobs, because so many is still revolve around coal producing power or coal using power plants.
That's correct. Unfortunately, I am not aware that Ohio has tried to apply for that yet.
Okay.
Well, if I may.
Sure, David.
This is David. In President Obama's budget last year that he presented to Congress, he included something called the Power Plus program. And it was a significant pot of money proposed to go to communities, coal mining communities, communities where plants that burn coal might be phasing out and being replaced. This would be transition money to help the communities and people who worked in those facilities. And this got nowhere in the Congress because the majority in the Congress is more intent on condemning the plan than it is on accepting the president's idea of putting some funding in to help communities with transition to a cleaner energy economy and better jobs. And so it's a missed opportunity, not just for the state, but on behalf of the Congress.
Noah Dormady, what do we know about these kinds of funds helping out communities, say, in Appalachia, Ohio, where they depend mightily on coal?
Well, it depends on how those funds are structured and how much of those funds actually get to the communities that need them. It depends greatly on the implementation and how that policy, you know, that money through that, you know, that actual policy mechanism is actually delivered to those regions. If you can get a state government or a regional planning agency like MORPC, for example, that is above board and doesn't skim a lot of that money off the top, to be quite honest with you, and a lot of it ends up in the hands of businesses or ends up in the hands of the actual low-income communities to meet those, say, environmental justice or low-income employment type, you know, measures like the Power Plus plan is intended for, those funds actually can do a great deal of help.
But you have to apply for them first.
Absolutely.
Well, the first thing is Congress has to appropriate them.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. So, Kathy Ann Kowalski, then, Ohio hasn't applied for it because actually the money's not appropriated yet.
Correct.
Okay.
And they also have not tried to – they haven't, as far as I know, proceeded under any of the credit programs that are also in the rule.
Tell us about the credit programs. How do those work?
Basically, if the state goes ahead and tries to get some energy efficiency programs in place for some of the areas that would be impacted, the low-income areas, particularly in Appalachia, they would be able to get some credits against their targets under the Clean Power Plan, as I understand it. And that has not moved at this point.
That's right. So, you know, Ohio and other states right now are in the at the beginning of deciding, first of all, whether they're going to write their own state plan. And most states, including Ohio, seem to be inching in that direction, or some are going full speed ahead. And when they write their plan, they have the opportunity, as Kathy mentioned, to opt into a credit program which gives extra credit for energy efficiency investments in low-income communities, and also credit for renewable power investments. So going back to what you were covering earlier, if the Ohio requirements for efficiency and renewables are allowed to kick back in, they will be very helpful in generating credits under this specific low-income program we just talked about, but also more generally that power companies can use. So when solar or wind power, for example, generates electricity with no carbon pollution, those new installations create credits that can be used to cover some of the obligation that a coal plant has. And a coal plant can actually continue to run above the limits if it has the credits from units that are running without any emissions or from energy efficiency investments.
Yeah, Noah?
I'm going to make a somewhat controversial comment here. And I think, you know, we're talking in many ways about subsidies for renewable energy. And if I can defend renewable energy for a moment, please allow me to do so. I think renewable energy is below the cost curve, and there's really no need to subsidize them. And particularly if a price is put on carbon, such as is really encouraged by the Clean Power Plan, we won't need to see additional subsidies like through these programs, through these incentives programs, because renewable energy will be in demand. Renewable energy and cleaner gas and cleaner burning coal will be the standard. That's what will be dispatched into our regional wholesale energy markets.
Well, I agree with that. And Congress in December, they did one very, very good thing. They extended the tax credits for renewable power, for solar and wind, for about 5 years. And that would cover the period between now and when the Clean Power Plan limits really kick in 2022. So after those Clean Power Plan limits kick in, the value from the mechanisms we were just talking about, the compliance value for wind and solar, will sort of pick up the slack for the and the tax credits won't be as needed. So this is actually quite a good bridge that Congress built to get us to 2022 and when the Clean Power Plan kicks in.
I think the one catch in what Noah said is the big if a price is put on carbon, because it's the whole concept of these externalized costs that are spread out. And so if you need first to have that price and carbon in place. And I think the other thing to keep in mind for Ohio is if you wanted to make an even playing field, it may be necessary for the legislature to revisit House Bill 483, which also in 2014 made it harder to put new wind farms in place in the state.
Right. And to go back to a little detail that I think it was David Doniger mentioned, as far as the opportunity to opt into the credit program, it would create credits for energy efficiency investments. That was part of what was going on in Ohio before they put a freeze on that. What are the objections, as you understand them, Kathy Ann Kowalski, by power companies to those kinds of energy efficiencies? Is it because they can't pass them on to the ratepayers, or what?
No, they can pass them on to the ratepayers because they are allowed to include that as a rider. One of the problems, if you're a utility in Ohio and your job is, and you're making money by how much you are selling in terms of how many kilowatts you get customers to buy every month, if you are selling less and less and less, they don't like that. And so that's one of the basic issues, is that they are kind of proceeding in a business as usual mode.
Mm-hmm.
So that's on the energy efficiency side. And on the renewable side, some of our utilities are also very heavily invested, at least their affiliates are, in coal plants.
Okay, so Noah Dormady, how do they make the transition?
Well, let me just go back real quick and add one additional revision to what you just said, Kathy Ann. And I think the point that needs to be made about riders, and riders have come up a lot recently in the First Energy and AEP cases here in Ohio. And, Ohio is a deregulated state. And those costs, if they're incurred by an independent power producer, which generates, who generate a substantial portion of the state's consumption of power, and in our PJM region as well, they don't have the ability to pass those costs through in riders. And so really those costs are passed through in a competitive wholesale market, and they have to compete with, in many cases, subsidized coal plants.
Right. That's true.
Okay. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. David Doniger, going forward, can you tell us what we know that there's a lawsuit out there. How proponents of the Clean Power Plan defend it in the courts?
Right. Well, there is a very, very aggressive litigation against the plan by the attorneys general of 27 states, by the coal industry, by the coal wing of the electric power industry, and others. But just because it's aggressive litigation doesn't mean it's effective litigation. And they've been losing round by round by round so far. Right now, they have a very, very unusual plea in front of the Supreme Court to step in and stay the plan. The lower court in Washington, D.C., called the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, denied that stay 2 weeks ago, and these guys went to the Supreme Court. My prediction is that the Supreme Court will say, no, they just don't do this. Maybe if someone's about to get executed, you can get a short stay of, literally a stay of execution, but you don't get this kind of intervention in a environmental standard or regulation like this. On the other side of the litigation defending it, there are 18 states, and there are the cleaner wing of the power industry, and, of course, the environmental organizations, including NRDC, my group.
Mm-hmm.
So this litigation is going to boil on for a while, but in the meantime, unless the Supreme Court was to issue this stay, it's like an injunction, in the meantime, the obligation of the states to work on their plans continues, and the litigation takes place side by side with it, but it doesn't stop the initial steps of implementation. The point is the litigation is going to be over long before power companies actually have to comply in 2022, and so all this near-term hubbub about the terrible harms is just hyperbole and nonsense.
President Obama has less than a year left in office at this point now. What about his replacement? How much does the future of this plan depend on who's in the Oval Office?
Well, it's if you look back to the 1970s and 1980s and 1990s, when the Clean Air Act was adopted by Congress, when we had a Congress that could adopt laws, the Clean Air Act was supported by Republicans and Democrats, and the votes were almost unanimous.
Mm-hmm.
Now everything has become very, very partisan, where the Republican Party candidates are denying that there is a climate problem. Denying that we can or should do anything about it. And on the other side, the Democratic candidates, both of them who are still in the race, are strongly pledged to continue this effort. So this is one area where the public has a very big choice, and if we have continuity, I think there's going to be redoubled efforts under the Clean Air Act, and eventually the Congress will have to get engaged again in a positive way.
I think it was Kathy Ann Kowalski who made the allusion to, you know, kale versus asparagus when it comes to what happens to the states if they fail to achieve their plans by June. David Doniger, can you tell us in more concrete terms what happens to states that don't?
Well, first of all, I don't think this is a choice of a bad vegetable.
Okay.
I like kale. I didn't mean that. I was just trying to use.
No, I mean, I like at least one of those vegetables.
No, I got what you were talking about, Kathy Anna.
But the here's the way the Clean Air Act works. Parts of the Clean Air Act regulate these big industries directly with no involvement at all of the states. So the EPA sets standards, let's say, for mercury or for the pollutants that cause acid rain. And the states don't have any role in that. And that's the way it should be, because these are big industries and they operate in national commerce, and the pollution goes across state lines and so forth. There are other parts of the Clean Air Act where Congress chose to give the states an invitation. You can write the plan to implement this federal standard, but if you don't do it, then the federal government will do it directly the way it does for these other programs I talked about. So the states have an opportunity to step in and design a plan that's tailored to the needs of Ohio, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But if they don't do it, it's EPA's obligation to regulate the power sector directly, just as it does for acid rain or mercury. And the carbon pollution regulations need to happen one way or the other. Now, we think the federal plan, if there has to be one, will be smart. It'll be flexible. It'll be cost-effective. But states have the opportunity to do things that are, you know, tailored to their own special circumstances in a way that EPA might not figure out. So it's still a much better deal for a state to write its own plan. And that's what's got almost every state working on a plan. There is no state that is drawing a line and saying, just say no.
Okay. Well, David Doniger, I want to thank you for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
To continue our conversation, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Clean Power Plan, which was unveiled last August, is set to begin, get rolling in 6 years. It requires states to meet the new standards by 2030. We're talking about the impact of those standards on Ohio, a state that gets almost 70% of its energy from coal. Still with us in the studio is OSU energy and environmental economist Noah Dormady. Noah, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you again.
And by phone, Midwest energy reporter Kathy Ann Kowalski. Thanks again, Kathy Ann. Kathy?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. And joining us by phone, the Executive Vice President of the Ohio Oil and Gas Association, Sean Bennett. Welcome to the show, Sean.
Hey, thank you.
We mentioned earlier that Ohio is one of a couple dozen or 27 states, I guess, to challenge the Clean Energy Plan in court. What is the challenge based on it? They haven't had a lot of luck so far, but what is the defense or the opposition to it?
Well, the opposition is pretty clear, because you see a regulatory overreach is what they're looking at here. You've for the first time, seen the EPA essentially trying to regulate energy markets. And I think they realize that there's an overstep there, as well as some of the provisions they're putting in classifying under 111D. So, you know, that is where they're standing right now. And we'll see where the courts lie on that. And I think those decisions are not going to be anytime soon. I think we're going to see those decisions kind of roll out years here in the future.
Doesn't the Clean Air Act, for instance, already regulate from the federal level?
Yes, they do. But what you're looking at is an aggregation of pollutants. So, you know, again, the EPA has always historically looked at the behind the fence. So whatever that exact, utility is emitting. Now you're looking at an aggregation throughout the state and bringing everything together and thereby kind of dictating how one state should develop their energy program within the state.
Right. So how, what sort of alternative approach can you take besides an aggregate approach when it comes to addressing the issue of climate change by way of carbon dioxide emissions?
Well, I think they are already addressing that from just the way that 111D is already implemented. So, you know, you can put in those regulations, and they have put in those regulations here over the years. You know, that is why you've seen, you know, not many new coal-fired power plants coming online. And you're seeing, from my industry standpoint, a lot of natural gas-fired power plants being built to kind of take away that excess capacity and generation. So, you know, at the end of the day, you know, utilities have to make that conscious decision. Are they going to be able to meet those regulations for that specific plant, or are they going to have to build a natural gas fired power plant or invest in renewables and so forth? So, you know, what you end up have happening is, you know, you're aggregating. So you're telling an electric utility how many plants that you can have online, what kind of plants you can have online, where it's taken away that business decision or the state's decision on how they want to essentially implement their electric generation, which is very important to a state like Ohio, which is a manufacturing state.
Right. You know, Noah Dormady, can you talk about the philosophy of aggregation in terms of the Clean Power Plan and why that's deemed more effective? Or Kathy Ann Kowalski?
Well, one of the things that comes to my mind is, again, looking at the overall history, you do have a lot of programs that regulate what comes out of a particular smokestack or a particular point source or pipe.
Right.
But in water, for example, you'll have water quality standards that are applicable to a whole stream. For air, you'll have an ozone standard that is supposed to be met by the whole area for the air. So it's not that much of a complete break, at least as I see it from having looked at a perspective in the area for a long time, to say we're going to try to look at this overall standard that's going to be nationwide and then we're going to tailor it to try to apply to different states. And, you know, one of the things that you also get to is you're not requiring every single facility, say, to come up with that 37% cut. You're basically saying, here's the flexibility. So arguably, I can see the other side of the argument saying, you know, we're adding some more options here. So those are just a few thoughts that come to mind.
Go ahead.
I think it's interesting that, you know, from the standpoint of the opponents of the Clean Power Plan, the argument is against aggregation. If we remember back in history to the Title IV to the Acid Rain program, the argument was in for aggregation, you know, in favor of aggregation. There was this whole bubbling debate as to whether or not we should use bubbling or individual level, you know, sulfur dioxide emissions at the plant level. And industry was very in favor of bubbling, having aggregate targets for sulfur, you know, for sulfur emissions, SO2 emissions from you know, within larger regions or within the company itself. And so the argument that the state would be an inappropriate unit of assessment for the Clean Power Plan, I think, is tenuous at best.
Sean Bennett, what about that? Can you address that?
Well, you know, this is where the irony of this whole situation kind of comes into play is my natural gas producers are the ones who benefit from the Clean Power Plan in the short term. So, you know, when you look at this plan as a whole, you know, from my industry standpoint, It is not being against the Clean Power Plan itself.
Okay.
You know, we may have issues with it and so forth. But, you know, we're not one of those main opponents. We're sitting on the sidelines. We're not in there with the AGs. We're not in there with the national
manufacturers. And that's because you have differing interests within your group itself.
We have differing interests. But, you know, again, this is really targeted to coal power generation. This isn't targeted necessarily to natural gas. You know, when you have that fuel switch, they're going to switch over to natural gas for the most part. And then you're going to start seeing that tail off towards the end as they implement those different blocks. So, you know, really, we're not there, you know, in the fight in regards to this. But, however, what we look, you know, as this as a whole, You know, philosophically, are we against this kind of implementation? Yes. And we look at it from the standpoint of, you know, this is kind of a situation of letting the camel's nose under the tent. And so while this plan may not affect our industry, However, the implementation of this plan, taking parts of this plan and looking down the road, you're setting up a dangerous precedent to where this can then be brought into the oil and gas industry, the manufacturing industry, the chemical industry, and you're going to start picking winners and losers and how much of one product can you manufacture so you can keep within these limits.
And you don't think it's the state's role to be doing that?
I don't think it's the federal government's role.
Well, the federal government's given the states the option to make up their plans, though.
Yeah, it's kind of a wink and a nod. But
it is. They already know what they have to do to achieve the goals.
Mm-hmm. They're giving them the goals, and they have to meet those goals. So again, from the clean power plant standpoint, that switch is going to be natural gas, and that is good for my industry. Because again, you know what you see happening in our market today.
That's the most affordable option at this point. But you've said, Noah Dormady, that there are other options out there that are equally as affordable.
Well, let me clarify a few points here. First of all, you know, I spoke with one public utilities commissioner here in Ohio a few months back. And some of the scenarios that the Public Utilities Commission, and it's unfortunate that Public Utilities Commissions don't get discussed more often because they are a major player in this.
Agreed.
You know, the Public Utilities Commission here in Ohio is looking at scenarios at which we're looking at 70% shift from coal to natural gas. And in the short run, to meet some of these interim targets, you know, Sean's absolutely right. The big winner will be if consumption of additional natural gas is a win, the big winner is definitely natural gas. But let me just add one clarification to that. The plan that's due under 111D that's due in June under the Clean Power Plan requires, as I said, three specific implementations. One is cleaner coal. Two is cleaner gas, and three is additional renewable energy. And so, you know, it's not just about shifting to natural gas. Mm-hmm. I think that's the biggest part of it, but it's also about renewables. It's also about more efficient coal.
Does the subsidizing, or you're saying subsidization wouldn't necessarily be necessary, but I'm grasping for words now. It doesn't happen very often. But support for the renewables, is that something that your industry objects to at this point?
It's a subsidy. I mean, let's call it what it is. And the reality is, you know, I think the market should dictate, you know, how you generate power. And if, you know, again, the implementation of new pollution controls makes coal less competitive and that does benefit natural gas, then the markets play out. And that's what you're seeing here today. As far as renewables, I think you're giving them an unfair upper hand and essentially trying to elevate them to a level that maybe they're not ready for prime time. You know, a lot of people call, you know, renewable fuels and alternative energy, but more or less it's a supplemental energy. You know, you're talking about an energy space that represents about 7% of the electric generation. You know, will that be able to handle a state like Ohio that has a big manufacturing base? Will that be able to handle the baseload generation? You know, are we going into a kind of an unknown area where we could get ourselves into a little more trouble than we initially anticipated?
Mean a little more subsidization?
Not subsidization, okay. But, you know, you look at times where you have possibly rolling blackouts. I mean, what if you don't have electric generation to take over some of these baseload peak times? You know, are you lifting renewables? Do I believe there's a place for renewables? I believe there's a place for all energy. You know, I'm not saying oil and gas needs to be there more than any other energy source. However, you know, you got to let the markets play out. And if at the end of the day it becomes more cost effective to use solar or wind, I believe that should be done. What you're seeing in the prairie states, you see hydro over in Washington State. You know, If you are going to produce, you need to, or if you're going to consume, you need to produce. And we're blessed with natural resources here in the state of Ohio. That is where that's our bread and butter. You can't necessarily say all of a sudden Ohio is going to be a solar state.
Well, we're not blessed with that. Yeah, that's for sure. And I was going to ask you, Kathy Ann Kowalski, from where you sit at Midwest Energy News, we don't have to talk about Ohio specifically. We can just talk about the Midwest in general. Uh-huh. It's not super sunny, and it's not necessarily super windy either. What do we make of the role of the renewables going forward?
Well, there's a couple of factors that come in. First, it may not be super sunny and it may not be super windy, but there is actually more capacity there than is currently being used.
More affordable capacity.
More affordable capacity that's there, especially if the setback rules were to change and we were to have more large-scale wind farms come back in. because they've pretty much frozen up at this point.
Yeah, tell us about those setback rules and what the effect was on the wind energy.
Basically, this was kind of put in the last few minutes, debated in House Bill 483, which was one of these big omnibus every 2 year budget bills. And it was put in and essentially tripled how far you needed to be from the nearest property line. And so what happened at that point was most of the large wind producers in the state said it was now not feasible because one of the large farms that's already there and already operating, and these are, you know, those can keep operating. Mm-hmm. But basically something that was like a gigantic farm would only have been able to have 12 turbines. And so that has had a big effect on planning. There's a bill before the Ohio legislature that would let some of the counties go ahead and say, no, let us go back to doing that. And that's actually supported by some of the Republicans in the Ohio legislature who are up in those areas and say they bring a lot of money into there. But it's unclear whether that's going to make it through the legislature or make it through without having a lot of other hurdles put in. And then when you look at kind of the costs of wind power or solar power or biogas, for example, some of those have steadily been coming down, and I haven't gone through all the latest costs for the U.S., but there was a study that came out in January that had costs in Europe within one penny of a euro when you looked at the levelized cost, basically once you took account of what were your, you know, put aside your fixed costs and figured it out. So they are getting to be closer in some respects. And again, the big issue, as Noah pointed out, is are you going to take account of any of the externalized costs or have a price on carbon? Because right now, a lot of the existing coal plants that are working in Ohio had been paid for by the ratepayers.
Noah? If I could just add one element to this, I agree with you, Kathy Ann and Sean, but I think I disagree in one respect. I think there is the Midwest does have a lot of renewable potential. We see a lot of very affordable wind coming out of both Illinois and Indiana. And, you know, truth be told, Illinois has a great deal of wind subsidies. But, you know, we see very affordable wind and very practical wind production farms in both of those states. Ohio State University gets 20% of its electricity from Iberdrola's wind farm across state lines over in Indiana at a very affordable rate. Ratepayers in Ohio have the ability to switch their residential supplier. And I recently switched this past summer from American Electric Power to IGS and lowered my – and I went 100% wind from their holdings in neighboring states and lowered my energy cost by about 40%. We're talking about some very affordable, very potential renewable capacity in the Midwest.
And I think one other thing that I would add there is the point that's implicit in what you said, Noah, is that Ohio is not a little energy island unto itself. We're part of a larger grid.
Absolutely.
That deals with, I think, 14 states mm-hmm. or 13 states right. plus D.C. And also there's work going on in energy storage that would help address some of the baseload issues that Sean referred to. Again, not saying that it would take care of the entire mm-hmm. chunk of it, but as energy storage technology becomes more advanced and more mainstream, that could have a big effect on the market too, I think.
If I can...
We're actually out of time.
Oh, that's
and,
all right.
which all of this just suggests to me, there's a lot more conversation to have.
Sure.
I appreciate you joining us today, Sean Bennett, to have the conversation.
Oh, my pleasure.
Sean Bennett, he's Executive Vice President of Ohio Oil and Gas Association. Also, Dr. Noah Dorbaty, Environmental Economist at OSU. Thanks for joining us, Noah.
Thank you so much.
And Kathy Ann Kowalski, a reporter at Midwest Energy News. Kathy Ann, thanks to you.
Sure. Sure. Thank you.
Thanks to everybody for listening. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Shia Lynette, our interns Summer Cartwright, who produced this show, Khalid Moalim, and Sydney Schaefer, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.